Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of Psyched to be with you. Today, my very special guest is the one and only Dr. Linda Kay, the Cyber Doctor, my very own Director of Studies. We chatted all things social psychology in video games, emojis in research, TEDx talks, PR, and we spoke a little bit about Linda's new book that's coming out in the beginning of next year. It was a really exciting chat. It's a bit of a bumper edition. I kind of mentioned that I might have split it. I've decided not to in the end, but it was a great conversation and one I really hope you'll enjoy. Linda also asked me the most challenging question I've been asked on one of these episodes so far, so stick around for that. It was really great, it was really fun, and I hope you enjoy it just as much as I did. Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Psyched to be with you. Oh my days, today is going to be a what we would call hot one in the business. I'm very excited, joined by another special guest. So this is episode, I think, 6 at this point, so I don't understand how we've reached this many, but here we are. So I'll pass it over to you, my special guest. If you could please tell us who you are, what you do, and when you're not doing that.
Hi, really nice to be here, Chris. Thank you for inviting me. So my name is Dr. Linda Kay, and I am a reader in psychology at Churchill University. And if for those people who don't know what a reader is, who might be international audiences or even in the UK, it's basically somewhere between being a lecturer and a professor. So research leadership. And I do a lot of stuff in cyber psychology, psychology of digital gaming and online behavior. And what do I do when I'm not doing that? I sing, I walk, I sunbathe and watch films. That's a very, very short version of that, but I will elaborate on any of those things in due course.
Lovely stuff. So yeah, full disclosure, you might be wondering how I managed to snag a guest this big. Well, that is because I am one of Linda's tutorees, PhDs, any of those. Linda is like my Director of Studies, the big cheese supervisor, if you will. Which is obviously a great honor and a privilege to be working with someone as fantastic. But you know, that helped me get a bit of leverage to get Linda on the show. So it all works, right? Bit of nepotism never hit anyone. So just to kick off then with just to break that down a little bit more, there's like, you know, the class system, the level system, there's lecturer, reader, then professor. How does that tier system work?
That is a very good question.
I have no idea, that's why I'm asking.
No, that's fair enough. To be honest, it's you've got these different terms in different places in the world, and usually the UK system is having an academic job, which where you're doing research and teaching, you'd be typically employed as a lecturer or a senior lecturer, depending what, you know, how much experience you've had. And then typically in the UK, before you get to sort of full-blown professor, where you're kind of internationally recognised for your research, where you've got X amount of research funding, et cetera, that you kind of usually apply for. In between that, you've got kind of readership, which sometimes is called things like associate professor, I think, at other places. The trouble is when you then look at the US, they use the term professor to refer to when you're a lecturer, so that makes it extra confusing when explaining this to international audiences. So yeah, reader basically is I do the same as when I was a senior lecturer, but just have a little bit more responsibility in research leadership. So basically do a bit more in doing things like staff development, capacity building, all those kind of things, which I really enjoy doing. So yeah, that's basically what I'm kind of paid to do.
Okay, that makes sense. I can see that. So how does one then, you mentioned like there's a few like different metrics in achieving professorship. Is that something that you're interested in, firstly?
I think so. I kind of have always kind of wanted to go up a kind of academic route, and that is the next sort of obvious place to go. There isn't really anywhere else to go unless I kind of moved out of academia. You know, the other sort of option is, you know, just going off and doing, you know, consultancy or whatever. But you know, if I was staying in academia, then yeah, that would be the next obvious step, you know, maybe a few years down the line before I start applying to that, because you kind of need to have had enough experience to demonstrate that you've brought in lots of money to your university and that you're internationally recognized and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So little bit of a way to go yet before I get there.
I'll be honest, and if you've listened to this show before, you'll know why this will gripe me. But why does it have to do with how much money you've brought in? Like, why capitalism? Why have we chosen this route?
Yeah, well, I'd like to know the same. But basically, that's the way her university operates. And particularly in the UK, most of the university's funds come from students' fees, which, you know, largely is actually paid by the government because most people, you know, get student loans. So the university has to make money somehow. And that's basically how to do it, by bringing in research income or doing knowledge exchange where you might be, you know, consulting broader. So that's the way it works, unfortunately. And getting money is very difficult, as part of the reason I've not actually been very successful on that so far.
Fair enough. So would you be able to tell us a bit more about what you've been up to, like, recently? We know, we've got, like, another thing we are going to talk about as a separate thing. So let's just focus on, like, what you've been up to academically or research-wise at the moment?
Yeah, so I've been involved in quite a lot. You know, my research has gone, I suppose, quite a bit broader than it always used to. My research traditionally had been on the psychology of digital gaming, and I suppose the underpinning thing I've always been interested in gaming is the sort of social thing of that. So what do we mean by social when we're thinking about gaming? And so my early research was very much looking at what we might class typically as social gaming, something like, you know, playing cooperatively or competitive with somebody in that time, in that context, and what do you experience in that moment? So did, you know, several studies from that kind of perspective, and then started broadening out really on this question about what do we mean by social. And this is where I started looking at these sort of broader conceptualizations of being social. So that's where things like social identity really started to come in, you know, how you define yourself based on the people that you were connected with, and this sort of social glue that kind of operates on a sort of psychological level. So you don't have to be in the same room with those people to be socially connected. So I did loads of research looking at kind of how that works for different gaming communities and how that's important for things like well-being, inclusion, that kind of thing. And I suppose there's kind of that question about being social is something I've still continued to be interested in, and is something I'm looking more at now in terms of things like social media behaviours and how do we understand what social is when we're, you know, interacting with other people on social media, the levels of that. Again, looking at how that might be important to think about things like inclusion and feeling connected, because I suppose the main overarching thing I'm interested in my research is thinking, well, why is this important societally? You know, we know that the need for human connection is a fundamental human need. And if we can understand how that operates online and what that intersection is in terms of our real world, in inverted commas, environments and context, then it's a really important thing to understand. So we're not looking at our technology behaviours as being something that's disconnecting us from the real world, but actually a part of that. So a lot of the research I've continued to do and have been doing recently has been kind of asking that question, I guess, in many different ways. But that's the essence of kind of what I'm interested in, I guess.
It's very much going against the grain, I suppose, in the I mean, you know, again, if you've listened to this before, we've discussed quite a lot the moral panic of video game studies and why that's a faff. You know, social media, again, you're trying to get funding for research and things like, well, what if this isn't all bad? And everyone's like, no, but it's obviously bad because social media, finger quotes, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see why that might be challenging. That overlaps with gaming quite well, I think, you know, in I think very much reinforced during the pandemic. Like, who wasn't playing Animal Crossings, let's be honest.
Well, yeah, without a doubt. And it was really interesting seeing the kind of very quick shift, because I did engage in quite a lot of like media interviews and journalists and stuff. And it was really interesting how very quickly I was then being asked questions about, oh, in what ways is gaming of keeping us connected to others? It's like, well, it always has been, actually. Interesting you should ask that.
That meme with the astronauts. It's like, has games been, video games connecting us? No, always have.
Always have. So it was, I mean, it was kind of refreshing. It was nice to see that and think, oh, well, finally. But, you know, that was just obviously quite specific at that point to a particular time and context. And I think, you know, it may have kind of there might be some longevity in those messages, but I think, you know, it has probably very quickly switched back again. You know, which is fair enough. Because, you know, it is useful to think about, you know, public debate, and obviously the media have a big role in that. And yeah, there are harms associated with things like social media and gaming. I'm not, you know, my research never precludes that that's an issue, but I think it's the balance of it, which is, you know, proportionately, you know, it's important to make sure it's a balanced kind of perspective and broadcasting. So it's, yeah, it was interesting when that happened. Yeah. But yeah, right. It's very much the case that I think my research has always felt very like I'm a salmon swimming upstream. It's always felt very much against where the mainstream rhetoric is. And, you know, I'm not afraid of a challenge, that's fine, but it is quite difficult, and you do find yourself trying to find creative ways of trying to, you know, break the mold a little bit and find effective ways of trying to break that kind of stereotype or that, you know, that main message. So, you know, I think what's been helpful on that is actually going back to the kind of core psychology. And this is where things like social identity theory is great, because it holds water. Any time you apply it for something, it holds a lot of water, and it's solid, it's robust. So you can then apply that and think, well, we know this applies to other things like, you know, community groups or whatever it might be. So why shouldn't it also apply to gaming groups or to, you know, whatever? So, you know, that's where you can start to kind of pick away a little bit at that kind of mainstream message and say, well, actually, no, there's something quite interesting and positive here.
I mean, you pick on a few really important points there. I think especially around, like, you have to acknowledge that for some people, and we don't know why, because correlation doesn't equal causation, but like video games can be maladaptive in the same way that anything can be. Cheese can be maladaptive for some people, you know. And there's definitely, like, people perceive any argument against that kind of, well, social media isn't that bad for you, or video games aren't bad for you, as a complete denial of, like, any kind of, oh, you're a social media denier, I think is a phrase I saw in a hashtag, you know. And it's like, no, we're just trying to bring genuine empirical, you know, kind of actual scientific study and data to examine this further. Because, if you know, there's that kind of philosophy, is it self-fulfilling prophecy? But, like, you know, if you're looking for something, you will find it, because you will make it. So.
Confirmation bias,
yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And you see that all the time. And, you know, that obviously doesn't help kind of public debate if, you know, people are cherry picking and, you know, and having that bias. But, yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem, I suppose I've observed this with whether it's gaming or social media or smartphones, or whatever technology happens to be the reference point, to be honest, is it's often talked about in very sort of dichotomous and polarized terms. It's like, are games bad? Is social media bad? It's like, well, yes and no. You know, what it can be concurrently both at the same time, actually, for any given person, actually. So that's not really very helpful when you kind of have such a broad reference point. So what I've started to write about, and in my forthcoming book, very shameless plug, is about this idea of looking at kind of a framework that looks at what, why, and how, you know, what you're engaging in, how you're engaging, and why you're engaging. You know, if you break down the question into those sort of components, then you can actually have different sort of offshoots of what might be harmful and what might not be. And you have different kind of combinations of all these things. So, yeah, by asking the question, are video games bad? Yes, they are. And no, they're not. It depends on what kind of games you're referring to, who's playing them, how they're playing them, why they're playing them, all these kind of things. So, yeah, it's that's part of the problem, I think, is that there's a very unnuanced perception of what social media is. Social media is massive. Even the different platforms themselves within that, different things you can do in those different platforms. You know, it's too broad a category, basically.
Have you found in, like, because I mean, one of the big things that is kind of the intersection, I think, of all of those, particularly around social identity and relationships and parasocial relationships, is Twitch, because that is a very community driven. It's very, you know, it's monetized, which adds questions to be asked, as well as, like, you know, it's not by and large video game centric, but generally, you know, I'd say the majority is, like, video game centric. So that kind of, like, is Have you thought about looking at Twitch research and gaming communities? Because that's something that you can foster a sense of community without playing the game specifically.
It's true. It's not something I've looked at specifically, but I'm aware of literature on that. And a lot of it is about, you know, spectatorship and what people get out of that and, you know, the reasons people do that. But it is interesting in terms of the kind of... it comes back to the question about is that social gaming? I would argue yes, because you're kind of connected via some kind of social engagement. And I suppose I've kind of thought when I've sort of reviewed... wrote a review recently on, you know, social gaming and what it means. And I think spectatorship, I think from what I remember writing about it, kind of came into that and was classed as that kind of, there wasn't necessarily a kind of interdependence between people, but that shouldn't be the only thing that is used to define what social is. It's kind of on the lower end of that, but still is kind of social. But yeah, definitely, I think would very much come under kind of community and things. So it's something that's very interesting. It's not something I've done, but I do have an incoming PhD student who is going to be looking more at some things related to that. So
if you want to look at Twitch specifically, you know, hit Linda up. Let's get a PhD application in. You come join the team, you know.
She's already going to be starting. She's already appointed. Let's get a whole team. It does need a whole team.
Okay, so you mentioned your book. We'll get onto that in a moment. I've got a couple of like other sort of smaller questions to lead up there, but the first big one is, are there any other like pieces of your work that you'd like to give mention to, sort of like specifically just to sort of to tell people about while you have this platform?
Oh, thank you. That's a very kind opportunity. I suppose two main things, really. One is, I suppose I don't actually do that much stuff on digital gaming now. Actually, I've sort of broadened out to other things, and part of the reason for that is I've just got great people who are doing their PhDs who are doing that stuff, yourself included in that, which is really nice. And it's I was kind of reflecting on this, and I think I put something on Twitter on before the weekend on this, and it made me feel really grateful actually that I'm kind of in a position to be able to do that, not only because I've had the security in my job to be able to get to the stage of my career that I'm at, but just to know that the people I'm handing the baton over to are, you know, are good people who do good research, who are very good researchers, and who'll do the research justice. So, I'm very grateful to have yourself and other people doing research that is aligned to my interests, which means that I can go off and flit around and do other things, which is always nice. Obviously the research you're doing and Beth will be doing are obviously around the sort of psychology of digital gaming. I'm doing some great stuff around that, obviously around, you know, the way that digital games can be, you know, pro-social in terms of, you know, receptivity of mental health things, which obviously is very important.
That's me. That's my research.
That's you.
They'll fund anything these days.
You can talk more about it than I can. You know, you're the expert on it.
Expert is a strong word.
And you own it. It's your intellectual property. So there's that stuff, which is great, and it's nice to be able to be in a kind of mentorship position to be able to support that kind of research, which is really, really kind of important. But the other research I'm doing is kind of looking at emoji. So whereas a lot of my research, the underpinning thing is looking at this, what is social? I suppose I've kind of branched out a little bit and now asking that question, what is emotional? I just keep coming back to the kind of core questions in psychology. The research we're doing there is really just asking that question, are emoji emotional? And you might be thinking, well, duh, yeah, obviously. But, you know, there's actually not that much research that actually really answers that question. And the reason we started asking that question is we were kind of asked these things. We did some public engagement events, sort of psychology in the pub sort of series, presenting some of the stuff we'd done on emoji previously. And, we, you know, the general public were kind of asking these sorts of questions and made me think, I'll have a look. I'll see what the literature's showing.
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, there was very little there.
That sounds amazing. Psychology in the pub. That sounds fantastic. Awesome.
That's a BPS thing, actually. It tends to be the branches that organise psychology in the pub. There are other sort of public engagement schemes like Cybar, similar scheme, really. Science in bars, it's great. What's not to love? But yeah, public engagement's really fun, actually. It's the first time I did it, I don't tend to get nervous when I'm public speaking, but yeah, it was sort of different. You know, you feel like you're a bit out in the wild and you're not safely in a lecture theatre, but it's a lot of fun, a lot of fun. And the best thing I've learned from doing public engagement is leave time to have a dialogue, because the general public will ask really sensible questions, and they actually ask the questions we are now answering in our research, and we would never have thought about such an obvious question to ask if we were looking at it academically. So I'd always encourage people, researchers, to get involved in doing public engagement. It is a lot of fun, and they say science and a pub, what's not to like?
Yeah. Sorry, you were talking about your emoji work there.
Yeah, so that's what kind of motivated that, really, from doing that public engagement. And just really what we're asking the question is using these many, you know, well-oiled methods from sort of more cognitive psychology and, you know, decision-making, lexical decision tasks and so on, is understanding, you know, do people actually automatically process them as emotional stimuli? So do we see a kind of what we call a processing advantage, like we do with emotional words compared to non-emotional words, for example? We know that is an effect that happens in psychology. So do we see the same effect for emoji? And we're finding actually, no, not really. we don't think they actually are necessarily processed fully, you know, at an automatic level in that way. But I mean, there's still kind of early days. You know, we've got some interesting things coming up. That's exciting.
Again, and obviously, like, I don't work for the platform, and I've been very critical of Twitch generally, as an aside. But it's again interesting to think about emojis or emotes, as they're sort of called on the platform, because you're like, on my channel, I have my own emotes. One's a freaking banana, you know. One's like, it's a 3D model of my face, you know, like with the word hype underneath it. Like, so even within, you have like, what are emotes and general things like hype and like hearts and stuff that people can attach symbolic meaning to, but even cross, like within a single stream, there can be emotes completely unique to that streamer and community. And that's a heck of a lot of diversity to try and research.
Yeah, and this is the thing which we're always very mindful of, is we're looking at very specific types of emoji, like these very sort of basic facial ones. So we're not ever generalizing across all types of emoji. But, you know, again, you see sort of things in the media, or what's, you know, talking about emoji in very basic terms, like, why do people use emoji? It's like, well, depends what kind, in what context, with whom. So, yeah, it's, again, it always comes back, I always come back to this issue, is that the reference point in the research is very broad when we look at technologies. And, you know, part of the kind of challenge of doing this research is really narrowing down what the reference point is. That's important, but then at the same time, that's risky, because, you know, several years ago, people might have been doing research on, I'm trying to think now of a platform that's shut down. Was it Bebo?
Bebo, yeah. I think I made a comeback recently, actually.
I can't remember what it's called. I don't know. I can't remember. Bebo, yeah, was it that? I can't remember. It just started sounding wrong when I did it in my head. But yeah, I mean, you could have been doing research on that, and then it closes down, and then if you're halfway through a PhD, you're screwed. So yeah, it's difficult getting the balance there, you know, when technologies might be a bit, you know, not necessarily stable. You don't know, do you?
Okay, so I feel obliged to ask, what is your favourite emoji, if you have one?
Yeah, the crying with laughter one, definitely. That's definitely one I probably use the most, because I often share silly things, particularly through WhatsApp. That's probably the one, my favourite one, because I suppose the connotations are associated with just things that are daft or funny. I wouldn't necessarily tend to use other types of emoji, because I wouldn't necessarily be sharing a lot of sad news, maybe. But yeah, I tend to use emoji most in WhatsApp, a little bit on Twitter, but actually very little anywhere else. And a lot of it is to do with the platform, because, you know, on things like, you know, if it's on my smartphone with a keyboard, that's a lot easier. But I don't often use them that much on Twitter, because you have to sort of find it on the, yeah, it's a bit more difficult. So yeah,
I have to say, I think mine is like, it's like the person like questioning, like the sort of hands like flat out to the side, like a what, I don't know, kind of.
I don't know. Yeah, that's when I use that one. Like, yeah, that one's a good one. I don't know.
I feel obliged to ask, and I suppose you don't have to answer, and I don't want to make the conversation more blue, but is there like any research being done on like the context of emojis? Because I remember the day I found out that fruits and vegetables were used for not shopping lists, shall we say? And I was quite like shocked by this, and like an aubergine can have all sorts of contexts. And I was like, I was genuinely shocked by this, and I felt very old when this happened.
Well, yeah, there is bits of research on context. Interesting, I shared this on Twitter the other day. Somebody had posted about the heart emoji and the different colours. And I was like, have I been using these wrong all the time? I was really surprised. So even different types of red hearts, you can be used in different ways. And I was like, oh dear. I mean, I tend to just use red hearts rather than any other colour. But yeah, anyway, that was enlightening.
But why would they be different? What would that mean?
I don't know. I think a lot of it's to do with the sentiment that you're associating. But yeah, that was quite enlightening.
I just use purple because I like purple.
Yeah, what's wrong with that? I can't remember what that one was. But yeah, I remember yellow was something like if you kind of upbeat and things like that. And blue was, tends to be bros who use it in, group chats and things like that. So I was like, oh, really?
You heard it here first. If you're in your group chat with your boys or your lasses, use blue hearts because that's what that means.
That's the thing to do, apparently. But yeah, anyway, so that was news to me. But yeah, there is research that looks at kind of context. It looks at it in different ways. So some looks at it in very specific contexts and controls that in the studies. So how emoji are appraised in relation to food items, for example. So how you associate sentiment with commercial products. So obviously that kind of stuff's useful, things like advertising and so on. Other research does look at kind of etiquette and that kind of stuff. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure specifically on the kind of the sexual kind of connotations and things, but yeah, definitely people are kind of looking at these sorts of things. It's context is key, really. I'm a social psychologist basically, so I always look at things in a social context to understand these things.
So that leads in quite nicely to, because I remember a contextual example from your TEDx talk on emojis. Firstly, what was that like as an experience? Because I'm not going to lie, it looked pretty dope as a viewer. can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yes, absolutely. It was such a good experience. It was probably one of the sort of highlights of my life, really.
A link to that will be attached to the description wherever you found this. Just
excellent. Thank you. Good plug. Probably one of the highlights of my life, really. And I always said it would be nice to be able to do a TED talk or a TEDx talk, and I just got invited to do it. I don't know who had nominated me or how I was sort of identified to do one, but either way, it was a lot of fun. And the one thing that was nice actually is you're in there with a kind of a group of other people doing all their talks, and you do feel like a bit of a family, really. And you're kind of there talking about a theme. So ours was to do with technology, and I can't remember the specific name of the theme now, but everybody was doing something that was sort of technologically kind of related, for many different disciplines, physics, bio, whatever, psychology, politics. But there was this kind of commonality that kind of brought everybody together, even though people were sort of talking about very, very different things. And it was a really cool experience. And you properly get, hosted and, have nice dinner, and you have to get put up in this nice hotel. And we were in Vienna, which is just like amazing. Yeah. And in this beautiful theatre, which is just beautiful. I didn't manage to see as much of Vienna as I would have liked to, unfortunately. But It was a wonderful experience, and I was just very excited about it. So I don't tend to get very nervous about public speaking. For me, it was more excitement and adrenaline and anticipation than nerves, really. But because you rehearse it so much, and you have a lot of coaching when you're doing a TED talk, and they really slow you down when you're talking. So when you get on the stage and that energy's there, you actually then talk at a normal pace, not like 100 miles an hour, which is normally the pace I would talk at if I was that excited. So it's a really good experience. I absolutely loved it.
I mean, as someone that speaks with great freneticism at times, I can empathize with that. So the talk was on emojis, and again, I should have watched this in advance of the interview. That's me being a bad
sorry,
host.
But
the example that I think got a great laugh from the crowd, but was also like a bit of an aha moment, was talking about the use of the wink emoji. And it was like an exchange of, it was a screenshot of a WhatsApp message, and it was like, oh, did you enjoy watching the film last night? And you were like, yeah. So in of itself, text is text, the words have meaning, we understand that, we process it. You throw a winky emoji in there, well, that suddenly we're telling a different story, right? Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. That is the context. Well done, well remembered. So I suppose it was sort of alluding to the kind of Netflix and chill thing. And I actually had to explain it to one of my colleagues before. I did a kind of rehearsal with my colleagues in a lecture theatre, sort of shortly before a few days before the talk. And I actually had to explain it to one of my colleagues, which was a bit embarrassing. I just told him to Google Netflix and chill, maybe incognito. So... I don't do it on the universe. That was nice that you kind of got that recognition and a laugh. And yeah, it's exactly that issue about context and how emoji can enhance and sometimes soften, sometimes, completely create a new meaning. And, there's examples, and I talk about this in some of my cyber psychology modules about the idea of digital identity and all this kind of stuff is, you can... emoji have been used in like criminal proceedings, as evidence of intent to harm another person. If you've got like they don't have the revolver emoji anymore, but with thumping symbols and an ambulance, and that might be directed to a person. Those kind of things have been used in criminal proceedings. So, just be careful in your emoji use, because it could be used as intent behavior.
Always bears thinking about. So my next sort of question, so pardon the build-up into this one, but you are one of the most active, I don't want to use the term busy because there's implications that, but you're one of the most active people I know. You talked about doing press stuff and that you like doing that, and, science in a pub. You are the current chair of the cyber psychology section, yeah? That's in the VPS, yeah? Obviously, you're a reader, psychology. You do stuff like this. Like, how is sort of... how's all that like combined? What's the BPS work like?
Yes, so the BPS stuff is really interesting to be involved in, because it kind of brings everything together actually in many ways. And I've actually been reflecting on this only the last few days, because I'm actually doing a talk for the student section. They're doing like a talks and thoughts thing about people's careers in psychology. And it was a nice opportunity to kind of think about things and how it all comes together. But actually what the sort of cyber psychology section stuff is just building a capacity really about bringing expertise together in cyber psychology. A lot of it has been, because we are a new section, I was one of four people who actually developed the section in the first place. And it's only been the section since 2018. So a lot of it has just been building capacity actually at this point. And what's really nice to see is it's the section itself is getting recognition. It's valued in the BPS. We bring people together. We're doing lots of stuff. It's helping the kind of reputation of cyber psychology actually, because it's now, you see it becoming more and more recognised as a thing, drawing attention to, why this is important. And that's all important when you think about the fact that so many of these issues are so public facing. So much of cyber psychology research is about raising public awareness, informing public debate, informing policy, practitioners, all this kind of stuff. And so, having that kind of reputation and good quality research, good researchers, people who work in industry who are doing good stuff in this is paramount really to the kind of why it's important in its role. And I'm always a very big advocate for that. And, I do a lot of that kind of sort of stuff as well, but definitely it needs a capacity of people to do that, because it's not going to go away. These issues about role of technology in society are only going to continue over time. And having lots of people who are doing this stuff, who can communicate this stuff, you need a team of people to make change really. So it's all very interesting, it's all very exciting.
So if for listeners' benefit, if you haven't sort of gathered already, I feel again, it'd be of interest to ask, because I don't want to use the term celebrity, because that's very socially sort of loaded, but you are someone with status, with gravitas. You're known in your field. You're founding member of the cyber psychology section of the British Psychological Society. You've done these TEDx talks. You've got a sizable Twitter following. You know, I was like, and again, for listeners, for context, within the academic sphere, that is not that well heard of. How do you manage that? What does that feel like?
It's always nice to know that the hard work you've put in is always appreciated by the community and maybe wider. So, you know, it's always nice to feel some kind of reward and some benefit to the kind of work you put in. So I think that's why the sort of cyber psychology section stuff has been rewarding, because it's like I can see that it's making a difference. And, you know, it's just nice just to kind of be recognized, I suppose, in that way. So thank you for mentioning those things. It's always nice.
It's just, again, because not every academic kind of is interested in that, or like is like, you know, no, digital platforming.
And that's fine.
And that's fine. But it's just interesting to work with someone who has this kind of, I'm trying to think of good words to describe, like an elevated position. Like you have some gravitas, right? There's no sort of denying that.
Yeah, it's very helpful, I find, and I know it has had benefits for opportunities that have come my way. And actually then a knock-on impact of that is then creating opportunities for other people, which is, you know, obviously important. I don't want to just, you know, take all the credit all the time. So it does help, you know, particularly Twitter I found has been really beneficial for, you know, helping raise profile and be visible. And that's important because, you know, that's often the kind of place where people become connected. So I often get requests via things like the direct messages from journalists and so on, because they've seen me on Twitter or so on and so forth. So it's kind of a vehicle really to sort of support that. So yeah, I think, you know, without Twitter, I don't think I would have had the same vehicle to be able to kind of have all those opportunities. So yeah, I definitely see the benefit of it.
Sorry, my brain is kind of going a few miles an hour here, but like the next little question is, wait, what's the origin of like Cyber Doctor? That's kind of like your like show name, I guess.
it's my consultancy name. That's I have my private consultancy, and that's trademarked. That's my kind of brand, I guess. It's self-descriptive. You know, I'm a doctor and I look at cyber psychology, so it kind of made sense. I think that was kind of a bit of a backlash against using the term cyber psychologist, which I'm always a bit mindful and wary about that. I would never describe myself as a cyber psychologist, because the term IST sort of implies it's a kind of protected, recognised title, which it isn't. You know, don't have a health council professional protected title of being a cyber psychologist like you would with a forensic psychologist or a clinical psychologist or a health psychologist, etc. So I'd always describe myself as a cyber psychology researcher or academic or something along those lines.
This actually cracks open a bit of a wider nut, because there's a bit of debate around, like, you know, do you use the term psychologist? Like, you know, because I know in particularly overseas in the US, like, you have to be registered. And that can be changed state by state to call yourself even a psychologist. There's people that argue that, like, well, you know, you've got a degree in psychology, so you are a psychologist. It's just what you're doing is maybe varied. I always say I'm a person that does the psychology, because for listeners' benefit, protected titles mean that you cannot call yourself like a forensic psychologist or a health psychologist without being registered with a certain body. I've spoken before about the importance of regulation, the fact that unfortunately you can go to these places online and become, through moral entrepreneuring, circa Dr. Kelly Dunlap, you can get qualified in anything. You can get a certificate in elevator music. Well, that doesn't, you know, but like who, I could write that on the back of a cereal box and send it to you. It doesn't necessarily pertain to anything. It's not held by any guidelines or it's not reviewed. How do you kind of feel about that wider kind of issue around recognition of psychology and psychology professionals?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to make that distinction. And although I'm talking in terms of the UK context with the British Psychological Society, you are allowed to call yourself a psychologist if you have got a doctorate. So I could call myself an academic psychologist. I personally prefer not to, because I see a psychologist as somebody who has gone through a health council and has got that training to be a practicing or, you know, professional route in that way. And I think, you know, that feeds into something important about public perceptions, because the general public generally, you know, without sounding, you know, harsh, but people often don't understand what psychologists do and what psychology is a lot of the time. And I don't think, you know, calling yourself a psychologist who doesn't actually, you know, help people in a clinic, for example, you know, I think it causes more confusion than anything really. So, yeah, I don't think I've ever come across an instance where I have actually referred to myself as a psychologist or an academic psychologist. I just call myself an academic or a cyber psychology researcher or whatever. It depends what context I'm in, but very rarely. And often if people are asking what I want to be referred to in things like, you know, news articles or the media things, you know, I'll always try and make sure that's clear. Sometimes people just write the wrong title and you can't do anything about it. But I'm always quite wary of using that term, to be honest. But people are allowed to, though. And I'm not, you know, it's their choice whether they want to or not. But
it's and this is like a buzzword for, like I say this a lot, but it's a language issue. Because, I mean, if I was going to be cheeky, I'd say, well, people could take cyber doctor to mean that you're someone that fixes computers, you know, because language is dumb, right? If you had a DM me like, can you fix me in for a PC repair, you know, like,
I've never actually had that, interestingly.
Because language is dumb and restrictive and English is bad, like, you know.
I've never thought of that before, actually, but yeah, I've never had one of those requests, actually, but if I do get one of those, I'll know where that's come from now.
So to dial back just a little bit, and you know, you don't have to, we've talked about the TEDx stuff, but have you had another, no, I'm going to say favourite because that's unfair, but maybe most memorable public appearance or interview that you've had, like, even if you've been, like, I don't know, interviewing someone else yourself, maybe? Most sort of significant, that's a science word again, another poor choice, but like, you know, one of your most fondly thought of PR interactions, how about that? There we go.
I've been really lucky to have quite a lot of nice interactions actually with people, but I think one of the, it's probably because there's a recency effect of being able to remember it, but I mean, recently The Psychologist, which is the British Psychological Society's magazine, the editor of that, John Sutton, set me up with an interview with Celia Hoden, who does some really cool stuff in applying academic insight into game design and the user experience. And she does some really cool stuff and has that kind of really nice balance between the academic insight and the industry knowledge. So having the opportunity to do sort of an interview with her was lovely, actually. Because, you know, she does some great stuff. I'm very, you know, admire the kind of stuff she does. And she breaks things down, and she's one of these people who's really excellent at sort of science communication. And, you know, in the books that she's got, she kind of breaks things down in such a way that's so accessible, you know, to people who might work in industry, for example. So that was a nice opportunity. One I can remember because it was quite recent, so I'm sure there's plenty of others as well.
No, that's fair. I mean, you know, Celia Hoden is an incredible force, I think it's fair to say.
She is.
And she does, like, that's pretty top tier. I'll give you that.
Yeah, it was good. It's a shame I just didn't actually properly kind of be in the same room as her, but, you know, the fact that we had that level of interaction and you know, really, yeah, grateful for John Sutton for actually setting that up. Actually, it was him who kind of facilitated that idea and brought us together. So
I'll be honest,
I'm sure I could have contacted her on Twitter, to be honest, but it was nice that was kind of mediated.
I'm not sure the universe could have withstood both of us in the same room. That might have been too much. Maybe it was just like a public health and safety thing that had to be done online, like,
yeah, massive risk assessment,
you know, to get, you know, anywhere too close to the Hadron Collider, you know. So let's move on then. Let's talk about your new book. You've got a new book coming out. Again, links to pre-order will be attached to wherever you found this.
Thank you. Yes, it's very exciting. So this is the first book I've written. I've written chapters for other people's books before and edited things, but this is the first book I've actually written, and it's been a really nice journey actually doing that. And so it's called Issues and Debates in Cyber Psychology, and it kind of does what it says on the tin, really. There's some really, really great text out there in cyber psychology actually, and I've certainly used a lot of them on, you know, my reading lists, and have been really informative for me as a researcher in this area. But I'd observed there wasn't really any kind of core text that sort of situated the evidence around what kind of core debates are currently around. So things like, you know, is social media good for well-being? You know, the kind of questions that you often see in the media and all that kind of stuff, questions I get asked by journalists and everything. So it seemed to me that having a resource that was kind of situated around those debates would possibly be useful, not just for students and academics, but maybe for, you know, journalists, media experts, whatever. So, that's what the book is. And it should be published, I think it's the 9th of January. So it is available to pre-order. And it's a very reasonable price. I'm just on Amazon at the moment, under £20. I would like to get it into some more smaller local independent bookshops though. I'm just working on that one at the moment.
Excellent. So is it more of a textbook style of book?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's academic. So it's around evidence and is referenced and so on. But part of writing it has been making sure that it is accessible, and trying to avoid where necessary, you know, academic jargon, and where possible, obviously it's not always possible, but just make it really clear what the kind of key messages are. And so something I've just been sort of writing a bit about today actually for a session I'm doing for my colleague. But you know, the key things with any external engagement and stuff is just knowing what those key messages are. And if you orientate everything around that and keep that at the heart of what you're doing, then it should be engaging and should be accessible. So, you know, I sort of think, well, what are the key things I want to make sure are translated here? And the book publisher, Open University Press, has been really good on allowing me to put sort of different pedagogic things in there, like take home boxes and things, so that things are really kind of clear and sort of easy to access and things. So yeah, it's been great. And another thing that my publisher's been good at is supporting me when I came up with the idea of doing little video excerpts. So on my website, I've got a whole page now where I'm hosting these sort of cyber bites, which I kind of host on YouTube.
Now that sounds like a serial ad buy.
Oh, what, sorry?
The serial ad buy, cyber bites.
Cyber bites. Yeah, it does a bit, actually.
Knowledge.
Yeah, but that's the thing, you can have them and digest them in small amounts. It's great. So, this is just basically... I'm using them at the moment really as part of the publicity, if I'm being completely honest, but I hope will be useful. And it's basically just a very short video, like no more than 2 minutes, which summarizes the take-home things of each chapter in the book. And that, you know, I'd hope that if people want to put my book on their reading list, then they could use that as like a kind of companion, hear from the author kind of thing. And I'll certainly be using it in my own module as well. So I think that kind of helps that message get across as well, having that those little bites alongside it.
Because, I mean, you know, we've talked about this offline, and it kind of is the ethos to kind of the science that we're working on, I guess you could say. But I've kind of noticed there's two kind of like distinct tracks people go down. I think you see people that maybe write a more academic textbook type of book and then reframe that in a much more kind of layperson perspective, you know, like, oh well, it's for public consumption. And then there's an argument on the other track that, well, actually academic shouldn't be separate, anyone should be able to pick up a book and read it. An example like that I'm reading at the moment, I'm reading Why Women Are Blamed for Everything by Dr. Jessica Taylor, and it's got a lot of academic discussion in it, but it is explained in such a way that I think anyone could pick it up and read it. You know, so like, where it's like methodology and it's very heavily referenced, which for the type of book that's important. But like, I think that anyone could listen to it and find it informative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's important to get that balance right. And I suppose if it was looking at it one end or other of the continuum, it would probably more towards the academic end of it. But, you know, I mean, the good thing about psychology generally, actually, and I found in my research, is just generally the topic is accessible because it speaks to people. People have something in their own lives that they can relate to with lots of these issues. So in some way that kind of makes it accessible in that you have that kind of experience that you've experienced. That choice of word. these experiences that, you know, you're aware of, and you understand these issues in practice from your own experience. So they can kind of be accessible in that way anyway. And I always find, you know, if I'm doing talks or whatever, people, it's always quite easy to capture your audience because people either know somebody who might have a smartphone issue or, you know, whatever it is, you know, they know that how technology is related to the way that they use it in everyday life. So it's often quite easy to kind of draw out the academic stuff because there's something kind of there anyway in terms of accessibility of those experiences.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I think, you know, especially when, as you might say, there was kind of a gap in the market anyway. Like, you know, you've got to start somewhere, right? And it's definitely the kind of thing that you want to be seen on reading lists, because I imagine the hope is that it will become a core text, you know? Is that not the ambition, I guess?
Hopefully. I mean, there's really good texts out there already, which I would always class as core text. This may more be sort of supplementary to that, I don't know. The trouble with, I suppose, any book in cyber psychology, it becomes very quickly out of date, and I suppose this one is no different on that one. You know, I'm already, you know, thinking, oh, these are things I need to now put in edition two.
Well,
there's already new research come out. It's too late to include it.
All the more
now.
Reason for your publishers to give you a second edition.
Yeah, I mean, they've been great to work with, and I think, you know, I've been very efficient with them. So I'd hope they'd be supportive of a second edition. There's already scope for at least one of the chapters to have a new edition already. And, you know, I've only just approved all the proofs for it. You know, it's crazy.
Well, I mean, anyway. Have you got anything else you'd like to sort of say about the book generally? I mean, how did you find, you said it's the first book that you've written in its entirety. How was that as an experience?
It was good. I mean, I did it during a global pandemic, and I think, I mean, I've written in the kind of this preface thing. I don't know whether that was like idiotic or genius, but
the line can be quite thin at times.
Yeah, I think in this case it probably is. I found it okay. What I found it really useful for was, and this is where the sort of synthesis really comes in, and I did sort of note that earlier and then didn't actually follow up on that, which I've now just thought remembered. I've just found myself in the last few years sort of doing so much stuff, and whether it's consultancy or BPS stuff or teaching or research or whatever, and not really ever getting an opportunity to kind of bring all that together. And what was the book was really useful for was had all these things buzzing around in my head, and it actually gave me an opportunity to sit down and think, right, I'm talking about these issues when I'm doing media things. I'm writing about this. How does it all fit together? And it was really nice, actually, to sort of synthesize that and just have an opportunity to kind of get it all in one place. And that was very sort of gratifying. I felt so much more satisfied having done that, because I know where I'm at now. I know where I'm up to on this issue now, because I've had the opportunity to piece all these disparate things together, which actually weren't disparate things. They were just different parts of a different piece of the puzzle, I think. So it's really useful doing that, and it's definitely kind of crystallized my own thinking about things, which I then find much easier when I come to write stuff or do talks on stuff or know what I need to do next. So the actual process of writing I actually found quite enjoyable, actually, because I actually quite like writing and quite efficient at it generally. So it was a good experience generally. The probably the most negative thing was very recently when I was writing the index. That was the most brain-numbing thing I've ever done. The publisher could have done it, but they would have taken stuff out of my royalties. And just, didn't want my royalties to because of that.
I mean, you know, I hate to say it slightly tongue in cheek, but you know, unfortunately, you might have to update the video game cyber psychology bit by the time you come to do edition two, because there's some hot research being done on that at the moment.
Absolutely. And it might be, you know, that some of those chapters get expanded out because, you know, it might be that there's issues that need teasing out further on some of those things. So I think that could be a nice avenue, actually, to develop edition two, definitely.
Well, if you want someone to write a chapter for one of your books, I'm available.
Excellent.
Shameless plug.
Thank you for your excellent offer.
Have you thought about, maybe this is a very premature question, but have you thought about, like would you write another book? Would you, if so, what would it be on? Would you write a novel? Why not?
Probably not a novel. I always used to enjoy kind of creative writing when I was younger. I used to really enjoy doing that. I used to just sometimes write stories for fun. I'm just a geek. But no, I probably wouldn't write a novel. I know I've got colleagues who've written loads of books, novels, and non-fiction books as well. I've enjoyed the experience this time, so I think I probably would be up for writing another book. What it would be on? I don't know, actually. Don't know at this point, but yeah, I definitely wouldn't. It's been favourable so far, so it wouldn't be something I'd turn down, I don't think. Depending what the offer was, I suppose.
So if you're a publisher out there listening, you know, Linda's, she'll think about it.
Table
the right offer, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
I think, I'm quite busy as it is, you know, as you very well know.
You are busy.
But I love the idea of writing a book and being able to, like, bring one's own sort of compilation to stuff. I think the problem I've encountered is that as I've been reading more around this, I've read a lot of books that I sit there and go, I wish I could have contributed to. Not that I have any right to have done that, but, you know, like Professor Peter Etchell's, Lost in a Good Game, you know, Checkpoint by Joe Donnelly, The Psychology of Final Fantasy and Legend of Zelda series, edited by Dr. Anthony Bean. Like, this, I mean, there's some great, that is like a, you know, a Rolls-Royce list of people talking about some of their favourite games. And they're great reads, by the way. I'd happily plug all of those books.
Really, really good books out there, and a lot have been very, you know, recent as well, really. So it's, I always feel very, very grateful to be around, you know, people doing great stuff. So, yeah, it's good.
Whereas I have that kind of like, you know, that kind of like, I wish I'd written that song, that kind of like, I wish I'd written this book. I could, you know.
Too late. Something else come up, something. Yeah. No, that just means something better will come up. So, at the right time as well.
I mean, we've just gone through the very long list of stuff that you get up to professionally.
Is that the first question?
Yeah, this can be a two-parter. Let's brace yourselves. What do you do when you're not doing all that? You mentioned you have some hobbies somehow.
Yes,
what do they look like? And, you know.
Yeah, so I'm in two choirs. So one of those, well, they're both sort of community choirs, I guess. One of them is a local one. So I live in Chorley, in Lancashire, and it's just a very local one there. And we sing loads of great songs, actually, tend to be sort of pop songs. So we do medleys like Elton John, we've done Queen before, we've done Bowie, we've done, what else have we done? Beatles, lots of great stuff, and great arrangements, actually. The choir leaders are really, really cool. So there's that one. And the other choir I'm in is a all-female a cappella choir, which is, I always find it's a bit more demanding, it's a bit more difficult. So that one kind of challenges me a lot more than the other one. Both are a lot of fun. So yes, I basically am singing when I've got spare time and rehearsing, and we can actually finally rehearse together now. You know, during lockdown didn't really feel like you're in a choir where you're on Zoom and you can't hear anybody else singing. You know, it kind of misses the whole point of being in a choir. So yeah, it's nice to be able to sing together, and it's just a nice sort of, it's lovely to sort of synchronise with other people and feel connected to other people, and it's wonderful.
So, I mean, does that, I know, you know, you've got other hobbies, but just to pick that up a little bit. So, I mean, you big fan of music? You're often blasting the tunes around the house? You sing, you know, the kind of person that sings while they're doing the cleaning? I mean, I do. You know, I go full on Freddie Mercury. I want to break free out there with the Hoover, like, just getting into it, you know?
Yeah, I do sing a lot, and I'm very lucky where I live. I actually have a detached house, which is probably a good job, because I think my neighbours would hate me. But my kitchen has amazing acoustics. So it's a really great environment to sing in. So yeah, that's usually where I sing. And yeah, often when I'm cleaning, I'll sort of blast out songs as well. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. But I mean, my music playlist is very eclectic. It goes from, you know, one extreme to the other. It could be, you know, like Disney sing along to like 70s rock, you know. You know, if I put it on like, you know, playlist, a mixed one, you could get anything. So yeah, it's a bit, I don't subject other people to my music, by the way. I don't think that's fair on anyone. But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
So if you were gonna like do like I don't know, maybe like the top 10 listen to songs on like your platform of choice, because many platforms are available, what do you think would sort of come up, you know, just to give us a flavour of that wide taste?
Yeah, I mean, I think people like, you know, Elton John, like the classics and things, I've got quite a lot of his songs on. I'm actually a really big Tom Jones fan, actually. Just a lot of his older music, actually.
It's not unusual.
I don't know why.
Hey.
Good. Yes. Yeah, so, a lot of him. What else might be on? Actually, I love musicals, and because I just love singing along to musicals as well. So I'd say a lot of musical albums and songs from the sort of showstoppers, Broadway things will come up a lot. Anything I can sing along to, actually. I mean, I don't tend to maybe sing along so much to like the Elton Johns. That might be more car music. But yeah, definitely musicals would be the thing I'd be blasting out in my kitchen.
Would you ever do any like would you ever take a role in a musical, or like do like a concert like solo or something, you know, like, or an open mic maybe?
Oh, I mean, I'd love to, but I just do not have the confidence to do that. I've done, you know, choir performances before. You know, I've done competitions as a choir. I've performed, you know, with the violin and piano, done concerts before. I've done, you know, I'm a trained, you know, gymnast, and I've done gymnastics routines in front of audience before. I probably just would not want to sing in front of people on my own, which is just ridiculous.
No, that's just fine.
When you think about the fact I've done a TED talk in front of like, you know, 1,000 people plus others who might have been watching. I mean, I don't know why, but just singing just in front of people just petrifies me if I'm not in a choir. But I'd love to. I mean, that would be such a dream to be blasting out on a Broadway stage, you know, one of the classics.
So a colleague threw this question to me, and I'll pose it to yourself now, and I'll ask for a musical as well. But you're at the Royal Albert Hall for a gig. The support act hasn't shown up, and the stage manager has seen your stuff on YouTube, and they say, can you go on and fill for at least 10 minutes? What would you do? God. So you don't have to, like, don't like get yourself all angsty like thinking about that happening, but what would that be? You've got like a mini set, maybe like two, three songs. What would you pick?
I'd probably do like a medley or something from musicals, like a set list of those. So it would just be, you know, I mean, what my absolute all-time favorite musical is Phantom of the Opera. I mean, I remember seeing that when I was about 15 at the Alhambra in Bradford, and I absolutely fell in love with it, and I don't think I've ever fallen out of love with it. So, I mean, I'd love to sing something from that, or maybe something from Wicked, or any of the big ones, really, to be quite honest. Maybe Hamilton. You know, I mean, a lot of the songs in Hamilton tend to be more the men songs, but there are some women ones. Yeah, any of those sort of big numbers, I guess. Maybe Memory from Cats.
I was going to say, if you could pick any musical to, I won't say star again, but like to feature in, to be in.
It would probably have to be Phantom of the Opera then.
Okay, fair. That's fair. So, I mean, that's some pretty, music I've found through these discussions is just so, it's such a big thing for so many people. And I think that's really great. And there is such diversity in it. So what else you mentioned? I think a few other things at the top of the show.
I mean, I like to get out and about walking. That's definitely something I've done more and more regularly, actually, since, I suppose, lockdowns and things.
It was all we could do.
Could do, exactly. And, you know, particularly when weather's nice, I'm a bit of a fair weather walker, actually. Just getting out and about is always nice. I'm really lucky where I live is that, you know, it's really not far to get to, like, the Lake District. So even locally, there's some really nice sort of scenic walks around. So you know, I can be in the Lake Districts and the South Lakes within about an hour. So it's really nice. It's lovely. I feel very lucky to be in this part of the country. And yes, I like doing that. If the weather's rubbish, then I mean, I'm a big film geek, so I just love my films. So I could just spend, particularly if the weather's bad, I could just spend an entire weekend in front of the TV watching films or Netflix or something. So yeah, I'd probably spend quite a bit of time with that as well.
Okay, so I feel obliged to ask how do you do it? I mean, you're so active. Yet you seem to find times for your hobby. I mean, is there actually, like, have you got a clone that you actually, like, team up with? Like, is that how it, like, how?
Yeah, well, you're not the first person who asked if I've got a clone, actually. Chris Fullwood, who's on the Cybersight Committee, has actually asked that before. Well, I do actually have a twin, but
Hold the presses. Stop the presses. Hold on.
I do have an identical twin. she doesn't actually operate as my clone. She's a...
That's exactly the kind of thing a clone would say, Linda.
No, she's an executive assistant, and she does all sorts, actually. She's brilliant, but she's ultra organized, ultra amazing, and basically keeps businesses on track by, you know, scheduling meetings at the right time and keeping them, you know, in order. So she does a good job there. But I'm kind of very conscientious during the working week, and I start work actually really quite early, usually 7:30 in the morning. But that means I'm usually done working by 4. Or if I am working after 4, I don't feel too guilty about it. It can be these nice fun things which are work related, but, you know, not, you know, hardcore work. So I just am very conscientious during the working week, and, you know, I'll just get stuff done. I'm very efficient usually, and quite efficient with time and resources. Which means then at the weekend, I very rarely work at the weekend, actually very rarely work in the evening, actually. And I think that is part of the reason why I'm so efficient and productive during the week, because I always have a break. So, you know, people work differently. People have different schedules. Some people work better in the evening. I work much better in the morning. I'm a morning person. So I work when I know I work best, if that makes sense. I know I don't work very well in the evenings, so there's no point trying to be productive then.
I mean, that in of itself, so people could say is a pretty big skill, like knowing when you work best and then trying to operate in that time. I mean, I've had...
It takes a lot of time.
And I won't name names, but like I've had emails from staff like at like 11 p.m. And I'm like, yeah, what are you... Get to sleep, get to bed, please. Like, I'm always like, I appreciate you sending that email. I understand that took effort and work and you're doing this and out of work time. But why? Why? Please, I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I never like to kind of suggest that working at different, you know, more unsocial hours is wrong, because that might be right for somebody. And if they've got, you know, this schedule that's... means they work better at that time, that's fair enough. But, you know, as long as people have got ways of working in a way and making sure that's balanced with life, then people can do what they want. And as long as it doesn't put undue pressure on for other people to work in the same way or put the same amount of expectations on other people, then I'm always very, very wary of that. You know, I often put a lot of expectation on myself, but I'm always very mindful about making sure I'm not putting that as pressure on other people. But particularly if I'm collaborating with people, you know, I did a blog post about this, actually. I am a self-confessed procrastinator.
I read this piece. I felt very seen.
That's who you are as well. It's interesting. So several years ago, I was in my office at work, and our colleague, who's Damien, actually, a very good friend with Damien, and he came in, he said, "You're a procrastinator." And I was like, What's that? And he just read this psychological science article, which is basically about this. And it's basically people who do things, probably have this compulsion to do things much earlier or in a very timely way before they might be needed, but end up often having to do more because they've done it too early. So rather than procrastinators who tend to put things off and who might do things last minute or late, procrastinators just have a compulsion to get stuff done. And it usually does end up, you actually end up doing more. I'll tell you a classic example of this. I've now updated my module handbook 3 times and had to re-upload it to Blackboard for this coming academic year because people have said, oh, can you make sure this goes in your module handbook? I was like, I've already done my module handbook. I need to do it again. So this is a classic example. If I'd waited till next week or the week after, I probably wouldn't have had to amend it 3 times now. And it's a classic example. And so, yes, the point I was making about this is that I'm very aware that I work in this probably quite unhealthy way, actually, in many ways. And I put that pressure in, and sometimes I'm speeding ahead with doing things, which probably isn't the best way to work. Because I acknowledge working through things a bit more slower, nurturing things often, particularly in academia, is actually really useful. And so if I'm working with other people, I will always be mindful about not putting that same pressure on them. You know, the slowness actually sometimes is really useful. And even though it might be really stressful for me going, I really need this paper written up, I just keep still. And it's a useful lesson, actually. And that's why I like collaborating, because you learn a lot from working with other people. But I've learned a lot about myself from working with other people. So you're a procrastinator too. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, so again, it's like if you're watching this as opposed to listening to it, the video will be on YouTube by the time you're hearing it. You know, like, I do all like the link to the guest and stuff and all that, like, ahead of time. I have those ready. You know, the layouts and stuff, I design those ahead of the interview. I don't do it on the day because, like, the idea of that makes me nervous. So I'm definitely in that boat, I think. Yeah, I mean, that's quite, I don't know, almost quite a nice sweet note there. We're just all about learning about yourself and about other people. I mean, collaboration is a very useful and powerful tool. My next question is, I realise a bit of a meme between us, because we joke about it. And you sort of spoke at the top about, pardon me, passing the baton on. But I always ask, have you played anything good lately? And the joke is that we would argue that you don't play enough video games, and the...
I know, it's so ironic. I don't get asked so much now at conferences and things. I don't tend to be presenting on gaming research, but I particularly as a woman as well, people always, you know, kind of surprised, like, oh, what are you doing gaming research? Oh, are you a gamer? And the answer is no, which is so ironic. I'm just interested in the psychology of it. I'm not actually interested, you know, I'm actually a play games myself. But yeah, I think it's a very ironic kind of thing, place to be in. I don't play enough games, apparently.
I'll just give everyone
a second.
I don't have
time to do it.
I'll just give everyone
a second. You were saying earlier, I don't
know how to play. I'll give people a second to pick themselves up after that revelation of games researcher doesn't play games. Massive breaking news. That goes against all the canon. But it's fine. It's all good. No shade. So, I mean, have you played anything good out of interest? Anything that you're like, oh, I remember that being a good game.
I suppose the memories of that come back from when I was like really little, and my dad had an Atari, and I used to love playing that, actually, with Pac-Man and Space Raiders, you know, the classics, really. And those are the kind of, I mean, I've played like little mobile games and stuff like that, you know, here and there, but yeah, I mean, those are the only games that kind of really come back as being memorable, really. And that was when we had a joystick. I mean, that's how old I am.
I mean, when are we going to get some, I'm going to say, YouTube content of, like, you know, like Cyber Doctor plays Celeste or Animal Crossings or something? I mean, that's what the world
You'll
needs.
You'll never find it. Like, no, maybe it does. I don't know. I mean, if you want to see me sort of just getting angry because I don't know what I'm doing, that's fine. Anyway. I don't think it'll be that interesting.
People would watch.
But it's like Gogglebox, you know, you just watch people, you know, being entertained by stuff, you know. Yeah. I don't think it'll be the most entertaining thing in the world, to be honest. It'll probably be me just going, what do I do? What button do I press?
Fair enough. So I will reshape the question to, you mentioned you're a bit of a film buff. Have you watched anything good lately? Are you a frequent cinema goer?
I always used to be. I've not been to the cinema since pre-pandemic, though. Still don't quite feel safe to do that and be in a kind of enclosed, non-ventilated space. But yes, I might have Netflix. I've got Disney Plus, you know, all the kind of streaming services. But I suppose the most recent things I've been watching, actually probably I've been watching quite a lot of the Marvel stuff recently on Disney Plus, going through those. I was talking to Jess, one of our colleagues from Edgehill, about this earlier today, actually, and she was saying she's watching Marvel, and there's quite a few I haven't seen yet, but yeah, I'm really enjoying those.
Are you going through them in like date order, MCU order, canonical order for each series?
I'm not, which I probably should be, because I didn't know what the best order was, to be honest, so I thought I'll just watch the ones that, because I've seen quite a lot of them. I've seen quite a few of them at the cinema. But there's some I just never really got around to seeing. So I'm just sort of picking, pick and mix kind of, which probably isn't the right way to do it, actually.
I suppose that's part of the versatility of the MCU as it was, is that you could do
that.
You
can watch them in themselves. Yeah, that's true. But yeah. So yeah, I'm just trying to think what else I've seen recently. It's difficult. See, this is interesting, actually. I was talking about this to somebody the other day, and going to the cinema has a whole experience around it, and I think it makes it much more memorable about things you've seen. And I was thinking this the other day about what our memories of new films might be if they've just been streamed rather than shown at the cinema. And it does kind of play on you, actually, which is why now I'm kind of trying to recall what I'm watching, because I'm just like, what new things have I seen recently?
I always joke that the cinema thing is a British thing because of how expensive it is. You'd remember it because just how much of an ordeal and an event it was, trying to get there with people, and you're trying to find your seats, and someone always needs to go to the toilet, and someone is always unhappy to pay the prices for the snacks. There's always someone that thinks the tickets are too expensive. I always joke that it's that inherent Britishness of like not willing to pay that much to watch a film that makes it memorable.
It probably is, actually. Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. Although, actually, I leave it a lot of that. I actually would go to the cinema on my own, to be honest. So you don't have everybody else complaining about stuff. Just get on with it. You don't have to argue about what film you want to see, where you're sitting, whether you need to get confectionaries or not. You know, just get on with it.
I mean, the answer is yes. Cinema popcorn is great. You know, like always.
Fair enough. Yeah.
In my view. Well, I want to pick something back up there in a second, but are you excited for any upcoming releases? I'm very, very hype for the new June film. At the time of recording, is out in a couple of weeks.
Oh, no. I'm looking forward to finally being able to see the Bond film, which obviously got postponed through pandemic. So it'd be nice. I mean, I think it's Daniel Craig's last one, and I think he's the best Bond,
that's an interesting statement.
I know that's probably controversial, but I'd say he's the best Bond. Not always necessarily being the best films, yeah, although some of them are.
Again, as a psychologist, this might be interesting to kind of tap, because a lot of people kind of say nostalgia is responsible for their favourite Bond. The joke being, your favourite Bond is the one you grew up with, usually. And like, even like in my case, like the first Bond I remember watching was Pierce Brosnan. Even though the first one, Daniel Craig was the first Bond that I was like, I went to the cinema to see Casino Royale when it came out. You know, like Mads Mikkelsen was fantastic.
The first one I would.
But like the first Bond, you just kind of, is that just nostalgia or?
Probably is, actually. But yeah, I'd be similar. Like the one I remember growing up would have been Pierce Brosnan as well. Obviously watched all the others sort of retrospectively. No, I think maybe I was just a bit young, or maybe just Bond didn't speak to me in the same way. I don't know. But you know, you appreciate films in different ways, as you know, when you're older compared to when you're younger. Maybe nostalgia has a role in it, though, possibly. But no, I do think Daniel Craig is the best Bond. I think he kind of encapsulates Bond best.
Fair enough. I mean, like, we could go into it's a whole other podcast of what is Bond, and it's a very interesting kind of rabbit hole to fall down.
The whole 007 thing, and then when people saying, oh no, you might have a female 007, like, oh no, you can't have a female Bond. It's like, no, it would be 007, not Bond. There's a distinction. It's just a number. So yeah, that kind of wound me up a bit, that people were just misunderstanding that.
I think if they were going to take a lesson for anywhere, look at Doctor Who. You know, it took far too long to have a female
Doctor
Who. Exactly,
and that was such a great, great move. She's great.
So we kind of touched on it a little bit, but kind of what's the next thing on your work? What's coming up next?
Oh, what is coming up next? bits and bobs, really. I mean, we're continuing with the emoji stuff. So we've got sort of some studies planned out there. So just to kind of hopefully more or less sort of finish off some of those things there and tie up a few loose ends. Other stuff, I suppose, is just... my mind's gone a bit blank now. I can't think.
You're doing that much. You're just that busy.
I just can't think what else am I doing. I mean, I'm on sort of other collaborations and stuff with other people. But to be honest, a lot of the stuff I'm doing is more just on, you know, other people's teams and just sort of mentoring or whatever. So, yeah, definitely the emoji stuff is definitely there. We've got that kind of planned out. But, yeah, other stuff that's just asking cool questions, basically. Because I can't think.
One of my favourite questions in these interviews is this next one. And if you had no limitations, what would you like to do? Complete blue sky, unlimited budget, access to participants, a huge research team, anyone you could ever need to do anything, you've got it. What would your research be? And I always preface, and again, apologies if you listened before with us, but you know, mine would be get people to play Celeste and record their just all of their responses to that through that journey.
Right. That would be cool. Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it would just be access to, you know, data, actually. Don't care about people, I just want the data. maybe that's too much of a scientist, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, getting, you know, be able to cooperate with social media companies, which, let's face it, are not easy to cooperate with. And, you know, just be able to actually get all that data about people and different types of interactions they have on social media, be able to do, you know, network analysis and all this kind of stuff with it. And you can answer some really cool questions by looking at, you know, the level of interaction people have with each other, where how central people are in communities. And I mean, you can use social network analysis now, you know, for public data. But I mean, I'm talking about the kind of the stuff that you usually have to go through a whole ethics process for and get loads of permissions for. And
you really, you know, want to be difficult. Able to get in like a paper that's like, we know what your emoji said last summer kind of stuff.
That would be a good title for a paper. I love that. Yeah. So yeah, those kind of things, really just having that real data and not have to go through the whole, because usually with research, I mean, it's the permissions and ethics thing that puts so much constraints on it. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, you know, ethics are there for a reason and, you know, are important. But of course it does put constraints on what you can do and can't do. So yeah, I mean, having that real data and loads of it, the richness of it, to be able to do stuff with it and network map it out in different ways and understand how it corresponds to all sorts of things like well-being and, you know, just to be able to, it's a scalability, I think, that, you know, would be nice to do that kind of stuff.
Okay, that's pretty yeah. good. So last sort of formal question then, I do want to go back to what you said before. And this is a new question, so apologies, you kind of, it's been tested on you, but it came to me like middle of the series. But is there a person like you, or thing that inspires you? Like, you know, I can reel off a list of people that inspire me, like academically and personally. There's none of them in this interview at the moment or anything at all, don't worry about that. Jokes. But like, you know, is there anyone that you are able to draw inspiration from?
Yes, you kind of preempted this earlier, so I'm glad you did, because it had given me time to think about it, so thank you. There are lots of people who inspire me. So, I mean, a lot of them tend to be women, because, you know, it's useful having good role models and things. That's not to say men don't inspire me, they do. But I think this one's a really very academic-y one, and somebody who I think does some such cool stuff and it speaks to me quite a lot, and she's called Dr. Jess Wade, and I don't know if any of you listening will have heard of her, but she is a physicist at I think it's Imperial London, and she spends basically every day at some point creating Wikipedia pages for underrepresented female scientists. So she's done this every single day for years. And I've heard her speak before, and she's very humble, a really inspirational person who is really just getting representation much better out there for not just women, but often Black women or from minorities. And you know, I kind of look at the investment that she's made in doing that and just think, wow, I mean, what a wonderful kind of selfless thing to do and to spend time doing. And, you know, when I've heard her speak before, she's talked about the kind of potential impact that's had, because then she's seen on that very year, those people have then been nominated for these sort of national awards because of the representation that people now are aware of these people. So I just think, you know, that's, and this is through Wikipedia, you know, that's the one thing to say, is that Wikipedia is often sort of badly thought of in terms of being a source that might not be reliable because it's editable. But the kind of flip side is that what can people do with this kind of open source, I guess you could call it, where you can just do such amazing things with this platform. So yeah, I'd like to say she's what she does is very inspirational, and the way she approaches it, being so humble and modest about it, is very, very humbling as well. So yes, I'd like to give a big thumbs up to her.
That's fair. I mean, it is worth saying it, you know, this is a new question, so I'm kind of just we're trying it as we go, but like, you know, obviously one draws inspiration from many people and
Absolutely, yeah, it's difficult pinpointing.
It's just nice to give people the space to, as you've just done there, give recognition to someone that they really do admire and get inspiration from. So I'd like to go back to, if you wouldn't mind talking about it, you mentioned, like, you know, you're happy to go to the cinema alone, something like that. That's something I've done. You recently did a Twitter thread about the challenges in being like a single person trying to do things on your own. If you've been with us before, if you've been on stream, I really dislike this discourse that your entire value socially is dependent on if you're in a romantic relationship for some reason, and it's completely arbitrary. I think in a blog post I told it to F off as an ideology. Would you like to just talk a bit more about like that thread and the experiences you've had there?
Yeah, the reason that prompted that was, I mean, there have been numerous experiences over the last few years, but this one for me just really kind of it just sort of really motivated me. And this was basically, I was trying to book, it's a bit sad, but it's just a little canal cruise thing, and it's just a little afternoon tea thing.
If that's a thing you like to do, let's just clarify that. You know, no,
feels like a middle-aged thing to do.
No hobby shaming on this podcast. Let's just get that out there.
Yeah, I just thought it would be nice. You know, it's in a scenic part of the world. So I wanted to book this, and I booked it obviously just for me, and then the organizer sort of emailed me after saying, I just want to check, you've just booked for one, I just want to make sure that you're not booking to join another party already booked. And I was like, no, I've booked for one because it's a treat for me, from me. Don't worry. I didn't make a mistake. And it kind of iteratively over the last few years, there've been so many examples of where it's, you've been kind of made to feel that you're kind of wrong because you're not in a couple or in a group or whatever. So there've been so many instances, you know, when I'd sort of turned up for like nature walks and things when I was in Centre Parks a couple of years ago, and there was kind of a group nature walk thing. I thought, oh, that'd be nice to do. And everybody was sort of waiting outside this little hut thing for the guide to come out. And everybody was there, and you know, had our tickets there, and he'd basically checked everybody else's tickets, and then it was just like, oh no, we'll set off, we're just waiting for the last group. Well, the group was me, and I was just literally standing there with everybody else. I was like, well, I'm here, if it's me you're waiting for. They're like, oh yeah, just expected I should have been there in a group rather than on my own. And there was lots of other examples of this kind of thing, and it was just like, why is this so difficult, and why can't people kind of understand that people in the, you know, hospitality and leisure sort of industries don't seem quite to be well adjusted to this. Like, often you can only book like through booking apps and things for restaurants. You can't book for one. It's usually the default is two or more. It's like, people can eat on their own. You know, it's allowed. It's possible. So I mean, yeah, it just kind of wound me up a bit.
I'm a big proponent. I mean, like you said there, treat yourself, a treat from you to you. I've taken myself out to dinner many a time. I will go out and just take an audiobook with me or a good podcast like this one you're listening to right now. Don't forget to like, subscribe, review. And just have a whale of a time myself. Like, what's the problem with like it? But it is funny. There is always this kind of like, are you sure you're not waiting for anyone? That weird reaction. And I find that to be really juxtaposed to how gaming is perceived. Like, you know, like, you know, like a, even in social settings, it's like you expect people to be on their own. you know, you don't expect people to turn up in groups to like maybe like gaming cafes and things like that. It's kind of like, there's that perception of, oh, you know, it's a one person, like, you know, in the mum's basement is the stereotype, isn't it? It's just really strange to hear that, like, you've had those experiences and faced, like, such just outright discrimination just for being a person.
I just don't think I've ever sort of felt it was, it's never been hostile, it's never been, you know, intended to be discriminatory, but, you know, it does kind of just start to grate a bit when it kind of happens, you know, a lot of the time. I mean, it's been all right the last year or so because I've not really gone anywhere, so, you know. That's maybe the benefit of the pandemic. You know, if you watch this in watching Disney Plus, you know, Disney Plus doesn't know that you're sitting on your own. It doesn't discriminate. But, you know, so it just gets a bit annoying, to be honest, which is where the rant kind of came from.
No, that's fair. And as I say, I think it's an interesting one and one that's, like, worthwhile having. As I say, there's just this weird social discourse on, like, individual like values and being on your own. It's really strange. Out of interest.
I was just going to say, the other thing that kind of grates on me is where people start saying, oh, you know, about starting a family, and I'm not bringing, you know, talking about, you know, the child issue here and whether you have children or not, but it's more, it's like, I've already got a family, you know, I need to start a family to be in a family, you know, I have parents, I have a sister, I have brother-in-law, and, you know, this, it's just like, the idea of starting a family is about whether you have children or not. It's like, no, that's not what family is. You know, family is much broader than that. So that's the one that always annoys me as well.
I mean, family is like family is like what you make it. You can have people who are part of your family who you don't have to be related by genetics to be family.
No, also true.
You know, so I think, yeah, that's it's a strange one. It's one that, you know, there's always a, I've heard it in a few different conversations, but there's always it's a when. Or like, when are you? And if you say no, there's always this kind of like, oh, you'll change your mind. This kind of like patronizing, oh, you'll change. And it's like, no, like, why can my, this is my opinion, it's my view. I have a right to live my life as a free, independent person. Well, you know, except when society decides not, but we'll sideball that one.
Yeah, I agree. There's very much an assumption that you will have children. It's like, no, who says I should?
I you know, obviously I can only speak for myself as a cisgender, real white presenting male, you know, but even then I feel like I felt that as like, oh, well, when are you going to get married? Are you going to have kids? Are the two, and you know, now it's a, when are you going to finish your PhD? Is the third one on top of that, but the questions are generally the same. I mean, how annoying is that for you? Like getting those
questions. I mean, when I was married, then it was the case of, you know, when are you having children, or, you know, that kind of thing. I'm, you know, divorced now, so I'm not married anymore. But it usually is now about, oh, when are you going to start dating again? When are you doing this? Don't need to. You know, I managed to forge a life where I'm actually really very happy right now and very content. And it's almost equating being in a relationship with being happy and being single with being lonely and sad. And it's like, no, actually, my experiences recently have actually been the opposite way around, because actually it's been the men in my life that have made things miserable, and I realise I'm a much better person when I'm on my own, actually, and I'm more content, and I can do all these things I want to do, and I think I'm a better friend, I'm a better daughter, I'm a better sister, so, you know, screw that.
Men... We have issues. Well, like, I cannot defend.
Yeah, and I'm not generalizing. Not all men are,
you know,
but the ones I've
contacted. I mean, you know, not all men is a meme, but like, even like, as I say, as someone who is in that category, I do sort of sit and face palm sometimes and just go, why? Like, why are we doing this? and you know, again, like, for the context of listeners, I'm very much raised by like and led by the women in my life. You know, I'm privileged to have an incredible, you know, mum who's been a great parent to me, and work with and be inspired by many brilliant women, you know. So, like, you know, obviously people go, well, that's what you kind of have picked up and can interpret, but yeah, it is a struggle. And I think, again, you put it really eloquently there. It's like, why do we equate that happiness and success are linked to being in a relationship, which is a completely arbitrary thing? I mean, even now, you know, I wrote quite candidly about, so like, my experiences dating. It's like, even the way people perceive relationships and what that means is so broad, and different and entangled in, and entrenched in just wildness, that it's almost like not meaningless per se, but just confused. It's like, you know what I mean? Like, it, so just the context is such, like, it's such an effort. I know it sounds daft to reduce to this, but like, it's such an effort to speak to people and to get to know someone and to like go through all that rigmarole that I don't blame people for being like, I can't be asked.
It is effortful dating. I'm just can't bother. I'm just lazy, maybe. I don't know. Don't have time for it anyway. Don't have time for dating. When would I be dating? Don't have time.
Too busy. No, I think, but like, I do just want to like really just reinforce that message of like, you don't need that type of thing. I think as you put it brilliantly yourself there. But yeah, so on that note, which is a great note to kind of end on, let's get to my favorite portion of the episode, which are the quick fire questions. So I always say that you're going on an island retreat. You're not being sent away. You're not stranded. You're just going on a retreat. And you can take one film, one album, one book, and I'd say one video game. But obviously, in this case, I can say like another entertainment medium. I'll maybe give you another film if you'd like to take with you. What do you take?
Okay. So, again, I'm glad you preempted this because, as we were saying before, I'm rubbish at thinking on my feet. So, yes, so film. I mean, there's lots to choose from. As I say, I'm a big film geek, but my all-time favourite film that I never get bored of watching is Monty Python, Life of Brian.
That is
my absolute favourite film. I just laugh every time I see it, and I could watch that probably just over and over. So that would definitely be one to watch, to take with me. Book, to be honest, with books, anything by Lee Child, any of the Jack Reacher series. I could read any of those probably over and over. I find those very engaging and entertaining. So don't know if you can see those. Might be able to. They're on the top shelf of my bookcase, a lot of those. So yes, those would be ones to take. Any kind of crime thrillers, actually, are kind of my thing. I really enjoy reading ones along those lines. Album. It took me a while to sort of, I don't think I can pinpoint one, to be honest, because as I was saying before, my musical kind of interests are so kind of eclectic. I think it would just have to be like a greatest hits of, you know, Elton John or something like that.
That's allowed.
There'd be so many good songs on there, you know, you don't think you could ever get bored of listening to that. Video game, we were going to pass on because...
I interviewed another guest, Rachel Button, who's the previous episode actually, and we swapped that for a board game, you know. So like, if it would be your preference, you can take a song book with you or something, like with some lyrics in, or another album or another film.
Okay, then. So another film, then. I'd probably go for Wedding Crashers. I just love that film. It's again really daft, but just really funny, really good film. Again, not one of the big blockbuster ones, but just very entertaining. So anything comedy tends to be good.
It's what you know. If you didn't laugh, you'd cry, right? You know.
Exactly.
And that's why I enjoy sci-fi dystopia.
Fair enough. Absolutely.
I joke. Right, well, that brings me to the end of my questions. I always like to do this, and it's a very sort of almost formal interview thing, but have you got any questions you'd like to ask me before we finish?
Yes, I do, and this is a really big question, so you can answer it however you like, really.
Oh, here we go.
So it's about gaming, about games, the role in society. And I'm kind of interested to know what your take on what do you think video games can tell us about humanity?
Oh, wow.
It's a big question. Or are there any aspects of games you think are revealing of that, or the way we engage in games or with each other in games? Or how do you think it kind of either defines us as, you know, in terms of humanity, or what the things are that you think it contributes, or answer it however you think?
I'll take it straight. Let's just go head on, you know, how did video games sort of, what was it, impacted humanity?
Or tell us about humanity. But yeah, you could answer
tell
it with
us,
impact.
Tell us about humanity. I think they tell us actually quite a lot in the same way that it doesn't apply to everything because, you know, games exist in all standards of quality and loved, you know, from attitude. But firstly, we have to kind of separate the distinction between entertainment and art. I have racked the mm-hmm. most hours in football games because I love football. I miss playing football off in the offline world, so I can, you know, supplement that by playing a lot of it online. And I enjoy it immensely. I've put hundreds of hours into various editions of Pro Evos and FIFAs and Rocket League because it just makes me happy. Those games are not necessarily art in the same way that Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifices or Celeste is or To the Moon is. You know, games that are truly artistic and have like this wonderfully spoken narrative and important devices. So if you make that distinction, art has been something that has told us about humanity since paintings on cave walls. And it has told us something about both the era we were in at the time, the imagination, and the ability of people to create things that we couldn't think of. You know, the genesis of what we now know as Super Mario was just Jumpman at the time, and the focus of that game was actually Donkey Kong. So what can that tell us about humanity in everything? Purely because not only have we learned our histories through art and that sort of contextual mediums, but also video games have that extra layer of interactivity, what makes them a unique form of a unique medium compared to other medias, that you actually have an impact. Most games, if you don't interact with it at all, nothing will happen. You know, the global popularity of games, you know, I think to quote my own statistics, I'm going to pretend to do that because I haven't got it up. But, you know, there were millions of pounds, millions of billions of dollars, millions of players play video games all the time. There must be a reason for that. It's not because we're all just bored, you know. And I'm someone that reads books and plays games and watches TV shows and watches films. So what does it tell us? It tells us that we like to have fun, that we like to play. Play is an important part of who we are. To touch on connectedness, one of my, you know, closest friends, we've been friends for years and years. We've had game night once a week, every week, for years. We were online before online gaming was, you know, a thing. Before it was as big as it is now. We would jump on a video service. We would play games online for a few hours. And I have other friends where the game is very much a conduit to just being able to talk. I think there's an element of toxic masculinity in that, and that men just can't just have a... Young men can't just... We can't just pick up the phone and just have a chat. That's definitely sort of feminized in popular culture, wrongly, in my opinion. Why is having a conversation gendered? I don't know. You know, we've had conversations where we're playing a game, like Rocket League or something, for a few hours and having a couple of drinks, but it's more about that conversation. It just is a background noise. It's ephemeral to the actual conversation that we're having. Lastly, you know, I think there are these vast communities and worlds, and I'd even go so far as say universes, that are built on games. Games provide experiences that people can't otherwise have. You know, as a person with albinism, as a person who is partially sighted, legally blind, whatever terminology you want to use, I'm never going to get to drive a car. I might be able to get a driverless car, but I can smash a few courses on Mario Kart. I can jump on GTA and drive around these fictional places. That's not an experience I could have otherwise. I realize I'm going on quite a lot here, but you know, so what does it tell us? I think everything and nothing at the same time, because people be the same but different. That's my experience. That's what I take from games. You know, a lot of the time it is mostly fun, and then sometimes I want to feel things. You know, RPGs are my favorite genre. What does it tell you about someone that's willing to sit and do repeated random battles for several hours just to get some slightly higher numbers on a screen that make things maybe slightly easier or slightly more fun? You know, the psychology of grinding is something I would love to look into. Like, as a big RPG fan, why do we do it? What's the point? And this is someone, again, that to add that extra layer of it, I've watched like YouTube videos of like one of my favorite streamers, Death Unites, who's a big Final Fantasy VII player. I've watched him just sit and grind 4 hours on YouTube, not even interactively on Twitch, just while he's just chatting along to people in chat, doing it. I'm not even getting any benefit of the grind, you know? So what does it tell us about humanity? Anything and everything. And I think the way we interpret that and, you know, the way people are researching it is very important. You need to do that in the right way, in a scientifically rigorous and fair way, and an honest and transparent way. And, you know, if only someone were, like, looking into, you know, I don't know, say, potential positive effects of games and how they might be, people might be receptive to messages, like, say, around a really important social topic, like, I don't know, mental health. I don't know, if someone's not working on that, they should be. Oh, wait. that me. There's this big scope for that, because if you've ever, you know, you're a film buff, if you've ever felt an emotion from watching a film, good or bad, having a laugh, or left a film going, wow, that spoke to me. I've had that transformative experience many times playing games, and particularly when I've played the types of games that I'm researching. What does this do to players? And there's next to no research on it, like, at all, you know. And even just, I think there's a general, to my knowledge, and it's not an extensive knowledge, but like just a lack of, like, well, what do people get from playing? What do people actually take from it? You know, there's a lot around, like, player motivations, and I know Nicky, there's the I forget the name of it, but the player motivations profile, and that's like a fun little questionnaire you can do, you know, and that tells you, like, a little, like, maybe what you're interested in. It's quite reflexive, it's self-report, there are methodological challenges about that, and it's how you feel at the time, maybe doesn't reflect you all the time, and all things like this. But it wouldn't be what it is if people didn't enjoy it and it didn't bring people together as much as it does. I mean, just yesterday, again at the time of recording, I went to see the Final Fantasy VII Remake Orchestra live in the Royal Albert Hall. And that was a collection of people from all around the world, from all different backgrounds, ethnicities, and universes themselves. They came together to enjoy the music of a game performed by a live orchestra and choir. You know, and it was a phenomenal experience. And if that doesn't give you a slight insight as to what video games can do when even a game isn't present, I was very emotional. I was very, like, you know, I was nearly in tears at a certain point. Such was the quality and the and, you know, relation of the music to the in-game events and images that I had an emotional reaction to it. So, you know, in conclusion, at the end of this essay, you know, what can video games tell us about humanity? Anything, everything, and probably nothing, because it'll probably be studied wrong.
That was such an epic answer. That went above and beyond. I mean, if I was giving that a mark, that would be like first class. Yeah.
You say that, but I'd have been 2,000 words over the word count, and I'd had to cut loads of it out, and then it would have made it like a 50.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what I'm hearing there is about the transformative things and the connection things. That seem to be the key themes that kind of come out of that, and that makes a lot of sense. That was such a good answer. Thank you very much for your insight there. That was so wonderful.
Heavily biased. I've been playing games since I was like 3 years old, you know, since I could hold the controller.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I was going to, like, unpack that more, I don't know, do I have a big attachment to games? Because when I was small, I didn't enjoy playing outside because I didn't like other children. They didn't like me. I didn't also like the sun. Personal albinism probs, lol. So I went inward to play games where I could experience these vast universes. You know, like, yeah, you could say I'm being overly positive and familial with games because they resonate with me on that level. That's a fair critique. I'm aware of that as a criticism. I'm aware of my own biases. But ultimately, if you, again, make that distinction between entertainment and art, art has always told us stuff about people and societies and the cultures at the time. Yeah, rightly or wrongly, it exposes the good and the bad. You know, there's some very bad games, and I mean games that touch on very bad things in a very poor way. And, you know, games exist like that. But that tells us something about the society and the culture at the time.
Yeah. No, it's a really important distinction. Yeah, very interesting. Thank you.
That was arguably the most intensive question I've been asked yet.
Well, I knew you'd have some really interesting insights, and you articulated them so well. If that was me thinking on my feet, I'd be like, but it was just some kind of, I don't know, it almost looked rehearsed, and it's not. I can guarantee I'd not send Chris this question in advance, if you.
I'm tentative to reveal this because obviously you are technically my primary supervisor, but I am gifted with the ability to just to bullcrap. To just let the brain just goes and the words come out, and because I've read a few books, it sounds very intelligent and very articulate.
It's not a bad skill to have, to be honest.
In actual fact, the inside of my brain was just a cow chewing grass, just going like, oh, okay.
And oh yeah,
there you go, you got an answer. So
it was a wonderful answer. Thank you.
Right, that about wraps up this episode. I say episode, I mean we've this. I may well split this in two for your convenience. So there'll be intros and outros spreaded throughout this, but don't worry about that. That's a post production issue. We'll sort that. So all that remains for me to say is, Linda, thank you so much for coming on. You've been a wonderful guest. It's been a really, really enjoyable
chat.
Thank
you for inviting me. It's been wonderful to have a chat. Thank you.
I have very much been psyched to be with you. And I will, again, also just let's heap some more flattery on it. I was incredibly excited to be working with you from the off. Even before my PhD application had even been approved or put in, I was emailing Linda and said, would you be interested in working on this? Would you be willing to help me with the application? Because God knows I'm awful at it. And you were nice enough to do that. And then here we are working together now on this my PhD quest, as I like to call it.
Indeed.
But yeah, thank you so much for being a guest. All that remains now is to go over to our visual final scene and say goodbye. So thank you everyone for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. And we'll see you again soon. Until then, take care of yourselves. And goodbye.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. As ever, if you did enjoy it, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really, really helps. If you want to keep up with all things Blind Psyche, check out the episode description for a link, or you can go direct to linktr.ee/blindpsyche. Thank you so much for listening. As ever, look after your mind, body, and soul, and I will see you again very, very soon. Bye-bye.